What does a librarian really do? More than you think. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. There's a new movie out this week called The Public. It's about a group of homeless men who barricade themselves inside of a library to keep from freezing to death in a winter storm.
When it gets this cold, I don't know why they don't just let us stay here.
Mr. Griffith, I gotta talk to you.
There's not enough shelter for us people on the street.
The movie tackles the way we view the homeless. The film's star and writer Emilio Estevez joins us in studio. Also, one of Argentina's most experimental artists of the 20th century is the focus of a new exhibit at the Lowe Museum. But first, we're going to talk with the Miami Herald about a disturbing investigation into a teacher who is charged with sexually battering students over a period of years. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Wendell Alfredo Nibs is a former physical education teacher for Miami-Dade Public Schools. He's facing a trial this summer for charges of sexually battering two female middle school students. But he was recently arrested after two more students came forward claiming that he raped them. A Miami Herald investigation showed that there were at least nine students who claimed sexual misconduct by Nibs over the 15 years that he taught for the district. Now, we reached out to Daisy Gonzalez-Diego, the spokesperson for the Miami-Dade Public Schools, for a comment, and we have not yet received a comment. However, in a statement to the Herald, she said this, quote, "The allegations against this former employee are clearly reprehensible. We will continue to provide whatever assistance is necessary to ensure swift prosecution of the individual charged with these disturbing accusations," end quote. Now, we should note the Miami-Dade County Public School District is the broadcast license holder of WLRN, but has no editorial control. We're joined now by the reporter of the investigation, Colleen Wright, joining us from WFSU in Tallahassee. Colleen, great to have you back.
Yeah, good to be back.
Let's clarify this. There's a lawsuit now against the district from three former students with possibly more lawsuits coming. What are they claiming specifically?
Yes, they are suing the Miami-Dade County Public School System for negligence and violation of civil rights. Of course, the alleged victims claim that they have a right to be safe at school and that they were there's three filed lawsuits. The two lawyers for the victims say that two more are coming, so that would be a total of five. Of those five, four girls, the plaintiffs in those lawsuits, have claimed that Nibs has raped them. One claimed that he sexually harassed her, asked her questions, has made inappropriate comments, and questioned her sexuality.
So altogether now, how many people have come forward and made these claims against Nibs?
Nine students. From 2004... He stopped teaching in 2017. He resigned from the school district the day he was booked into jail. That was November 30th, 2017. But now, you know, as you said, last week he was rearrested on Wednesday for two more students. And those allegations, I believe off the top of my head, happened in 2014.
All right. Tell us a little bit about Wendell Alfredo Nibs, how he became a teacher in the district.
So he has actually been employed by the Miami-Dade County Public School System since 2001. He's stayed at schools in Miami's urban core. He was a substitute teacher for a while. He had some stints as a security monitor, but he became a in-school suspension teacher in 2003 at Brownsville Middle, and he stayed there until he resigned. He later also became a physical education teacher, and he coached several sports at the middle school level, like track, off the top of my head, track for boys and girls. I think basketball is also in there. So he coached some middle school level sports as well.
So when did the first complaint about Nibs come in, and what was it?
It came about 6 months after he started working at Brownsville. So if he started at Brownsville in November 2003, according to records, the first complaint came May 2004. And one girl alleged that he grabbed her, and that investigation kind of played out. But what's interesting is that while that investigation was happening, another girl, who apparently was not friends with the first girl, also heard that there was an allegation against him and came forward with her own allegation as well, that he had asked her questions about her sex life. But both were deemed unfounded. During that investigation, NIBS was moved to a non-student work site for the period of the investigation, but that was actually the first time until 2017, right at the end of his career, that he would actually be moved away while being investigated. So after that, five more students came forward, and not counting the other two that were arrested, that led to the arrest on Wednesday. Those two girls are not among the documented complaints in his file held at the district.
So what's supposed to happen when a complaint comes in about a teacher, whether they're sexually harassing or assaulting a student, I mean, in any way, what is the district supposed to do? What is it? What does the rule book say?
Sure. So, of course, we've asked the district for comment. They've declined, citing pending litigation. That's pretty typical. But there were a lot of inconsistencies just looking over the files with how the district handled the investigations. Some of them were done by their own Miami-Dade Schools police force. Some of them were done by civilian investigators. Every time up until the time he was first arrested in 2017, they were deemed unfounded, mostly citing that there were no witnesses or evidence that, you know, he had actually either sexually assaulted or harassed these girls. But there seemed to be some pretty fundamental flaws in the investigative process. And in one case from 2015, or I believe 2016, a civilian investigator actually asked a girl about her decorum in class, her behavior. You know, she uses her phone. Does she walk out of class? Does she cuss? I'm not sure why any of that is relevant to a girl claiming, you know, that he made sexually inappropriate comments to her, questioned her sexuality. But there just seemed to be, and there was a pattern in how NIBS denied the cases. There was a pattern in even what he allegedly said to girls, but every time still was unfounded until 2017 in his first arrest.
I'm talking with the Miami Herald's Colleen Wright. Miami-Dade middle school teacher Wendell Nibbs, well, he's retired actually, faces multiple charges for allegedly sexually assaulting students over the course of more than a decade. And she's joining us again from the studios of WFSU in Tallahassee. Okay, so again, the district gave you a statement because of the litigation. They're not saying anything right now. Again, we've also reached out to them, still waiting to hear back. Wendell Nibbs faced these investigators back in 2015, and odd, because during the investigation he actually said, oh, there have been complaints against me, quote, if there's smoke there's a fire. Nothing happened to him. What was the district looking at into at that time? Was it just one or two particular complaints, or going back his entire time at the district?
Mm-hmm. So that was complaint number five in 2015. A girl had come forward saying that he asked her, and I can't say this on the air, but when are you going to let me see your blank? And he was referring to genitals. And what's interesting about that particular incident, because it was a Miami-Dade Schools police detective who was taking on that investigation. Her name is Bernice Charlie. And he had made that comment of, I guess, you know, I know the district is looking into a few allegations against me. I guess when there's smoke, there's fire. And she had noted in her arrest affidavit later in 2017 that he had said that. And she also wrote in the 2017 report that it had stuck with her. What's also significant about that specific complaint is that the girl who brought that allegation had also mentioned that she thought she saw nude photos containing her friend, her school-age friend, also a student at Brownsville Middle, and Nibbs, and that they were exchanging them. She saw them on her friend's cell phone. What's also significant is that that girl who Nibbs allegedly said when there's smoke there's fire to later also came back and said that he had raped her forcibly in his classroom. He had an office in his classroom, according to documents. And the girl That was another one. But what's interesting about these investigations is that in some of the cases, one girl said, you know, hey, this is happening over here, too. You should look into this investigation. And investigators would, but it took some time. It was kind of played out over time that seemed like this web of investigations and web of accusations.
And the school district hasn't said a lot because, again, of the litigation. But was there anybody who could give any kind of explanation as to how this person was able to stay in that position for so many years, even after complaint kept coming out?
Sure. You know, we don't really have much on that. I know that Alberto, I did have a very brief sit down with Alberto Carvalho, the superintendent, who did say that he's ordered investigators, his staff, to go back and find other cases where this might, where there might have been repeated allegations, and maybe go back and try to reopen those cases. But really, that's still the big question, is how was he able to? I know that a memo went out to school board members saying that the investigative practices have kind of changed now. Because now, for example, if there's any claim of sexual harassment, anything sexual in nature, it'll now always be handled by Miami-Dade Schools Police. And if it involves battery, it will now be Miami-Dade Police investigating that. That's our countywide police agency.
Now, Wendell Nibbs held a unique position with the teachers union. Explain how involved he was with the union.
Mm-hmm. So he was an elected steward at Brownsville Middle School. He was elected by his peers, and that's like a steward position, right? You represent your school. There's about one or two stewards, I guess, per school in the district. But he ran with the Frontline Caucus. So to explain, it's like political parties, right? Democratic Party, Republican Party, that exists within the union, right, for leadership positions. And so he ran with the Frontline Caucus as a delegate in February 2016. He was actually at the time under investigation for groping a fellow teacher at Brownsville Middle. And he ran, and he seemed pretty in the in crowd with the union. I know that they campaigned in Tallahassee together, and I also had several stewards on the record saying that he at union meetings would intimidate or bully any stewards who questioned leadership. So it kind of calls into question maybe what relationship was there.
And what has the union said about the recent arrest and all of these mm-hmm. women who have come forward?
Sure. So we reached out multiple times since January and again on Friday. The statement that I got was through a spokeswoman. And it was pretty much, you know, that if the school district has cleared people to work in the classroom if they're qualified, then that's good as far as the union is concerned. Now, after the fact, the president, the United Teachers of Dade, President Carl Hernandez Matz, has put out a statement to condemning, of course, the acts and calling for justice for the victims.
And the part of that statement that you had posted, it came from the UTD President Carl Hernandez Matz. Mm-hmm. Just part of what you had posted, it said, it is abominable to say that I would consciously and willingly associate myself with someone that is being accused of such repulsive actions. He may have fooled us all, but his accusers must be heard. Again, this coming from the union. My heart breaks for the children who are coming forward and lost their innocence to these horrific events. I pray that justice is swift. Our schools should be safe havens, and this should have been properly handled by our school district through appropriate investigations. These types of incidents are never tolerated and are a betrayal to the trust and dignity of all our teachers. You made an important note about Brownsville Middle School in your reporting. It's the only Miami-Dade school in the state listed underperforming schools. How are these students particularly vulnerable targets?
It was very difficult to read the details and who these girls were in the documented allegations. These girls were mostly 14, with the exception of one who claims that her abuse started when she was in sixth grade, which would put her at about 12 years old. The rest are 14, 15, 16 years old. I think there might be one 17-year-old in there. And, you know, it's interesting to me how they make a note in the investigations that, you know, like one girl, she said that Nibbs had harassed her, and she was in the assistant principal's office that day for skipping class. These were girls that, according to documents, you know, they weren't great students. They would skip class, cuss, were in school suspension. Very vulnerable. Brownsville Middle, you know, for context, you're right, it's the only school in all of Miami-Dade County to be on the state's list of low-performing schools, and that's defined as having, I believe, like 3 D's or F's within the past few years or so, and it's 100% economically disadvantaged, 100% minority.
And you
just
said
really dire circumstances.
You've also been pointing out the fact that, you know, yeah, they've been challenging the credibility of, you know, some of these students because of their background.
Yes. And I think I was crossing my lines a little bit. There's a lot of girls to keep track of. But in the 2016 complaint, that was the one where she says that, you know, Nibbs questioned her sexuality and made extremely inappropriate comments. the investigator, the civilian investigator, actually interviewed Nibs first and then interviewed a witness, another student, who even told the investigator, you know, the reason why she skips PE class is because she doesn't want to dress out because of the way Nibs looks at her body. And then the investigator went to the girl, so this is the third person she's talking to, and asked her a bunch of questions about why she's failing, how were her grades, why does she skip, why does she storm out of class, why does she use her phone in class. I mean, it was extremely illuminating.
Real quickly to finish up here is, I mean, do we have a sense of, again, how the district is supposed to handle this? Or are there any conversations about the district revisiting, you know, I guess, processes to make sure that you don't have a teacher or anybody in a position of authority who is sticking around, you know, too long if there are a lot of complaints coming in about them?
Yes. So Carvalho, you know, like I said, put out that email or that memo detailing, you know, all the changes to the legislative process. I named one of them about Miami-Dade Police, you know, investigating. There was also an important note there that allegations of a sexual nature could never just be independently closed, kind of like how they were looking at these. And it's important to note that the first time Nibs was arrested was November 2017. This memo, some of the changes that are there, happened November 2018, a year later. And the memo itself went out in February. We started asking the district about Nibs in January when the civil suits were filed. So it's interesting that that these changes are taking place now.
It is a hard story to believe, but, you know, a really very sad story. All of this is going down again. Investigation still underway. Lawsuits underway as well. Colleen Wright, reporter for the Miami Herald, digging in deep on this one to find, you know, more about a teacher who has got a lot of complaints of sexual battery over many years. Colleen, thank you for your reporting. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Again, she joined us from the studios of WFSU in Tallahassee. Well, still to come, we're going to talk about a new film coming out. It's going to change the way you view librarians, I promise. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Thanks again for joining us. Now, if I asked you, who does a library serve? What is the purpose of a library? What would you say? Well, it's a place to find books, information, maybe a quiet place to do your studies. For some, though, it's a safe, warm space to use a computer, because not everybody has a computer, and not everybody has a home to go to. The library is the setting for a new drama written and directed and starring Emilio Estevez. It's titled The Public. The film is set inside the Cincinnati Public Library as the city experiences an Arctic chill. Estevez plays Stuart Goodson, a librarian who finds himself in a difficult position as a group of homeless men that regularly visits a library decide that they're not going to leave when the library closes.
When it gets this cold, I don't know why they don't just let us stay here.
Mr. Goodson, I got to talk to you.
There's not enough shelter for us people on the street.
Who is us?
We could all come stay at your place.
The film also stars Alec Baldwin, who plays the detective handling negotiations, and Miami's own Gabrielle Union as a reporter who's covering the events as they unfold. The film opens in theaters across South Florida this weekend. Joining us now in studio to discuss this, the film's co-writer, director, star, Emilio Estevez. Emilio, such a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me on.
I deeply appreciate it. Also joining us is Ray Baker, director of the Miami-Dade Public Libraries. Ray, thanks so much for coming in.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
All right. And you know what? We will mention, too, by the way, that you know, we are actually looking for people's stories about their library, your library in your town. And so stick around, because I'm going to ask you a little bit more about your stories. But I wanted to ask you both this. I mean, you know, we live in this era where, you know, I've got Google, I've got Netflix, I've got everything I want at home. It's really easy. But I wanted to know, you know, how Americans view their library today and why we still think libraries are important. Emilio, what do you think?
Well, first of all, librarians were the first Google.
The first, that's true.
Right. That's and I think true. We have to remember that, you know, and that space, that sacred space where a patron approaches the desk reference librarian and asks the question, guess what happens there? They get the question answered, and the library is where facts live. And while they're getting that service, they're not getting bombarded with ads. They're not getting bombarded with spam.
That's a good point.
Right? So recently, Forbes posted an article, I don't know if you know this, but online, and it was, why do we need libraries when there's Google and Amazon? Well, they were forced to take it down after 2 days because of the outrage by public librarians who said, this guy is full of it. And they shouted him down. So librarians were known mostly for being quiet. We're not quiet on this subject.
No, that I did not know about that. It's a fascinating article. I got to find it. But Ray, for you, who is the library for, really?
Well, it's for everybody. I mean, we serve people from from birth to death, so to speak. And we have people from every demographic and economic background throughout the entire county. And even if you drive through our 50 libraries throughout the county, they're all in different neighborhoods, different communities, with people with different backgrounds. So, yes, for everybody.
The library is, anybody who goes, people still, I go to a couple of different ones, and I see a lot of folks, a lot of people do still go to the library. Emilio, the origins of this project I found really fascinating, because it goes back more than a decade.
That's right.
You read an essay, and it sparked this idea. I think the essay was about the Los Angeles Public Library, entitled What They Didn't Teach Us in Library School, The Public Library as an Asylum for Homelessness.
That's right.
How did you find that?
Well, it was printed in the LA Times, but it was written by a Salt Lake City librarian, assistant director. And his name is Chip Ward, Chip you'd know as an activist, as an environmentalist, and an author. So he wrote this piece. It was printed or posted on Tom's Dispatch, but then the LA Times picked it up. I read it. I was moved by it. I had done the bulk of my research for another film called Bobby at the downtown branch of LAPL. And so I knew what Chip Ward was talking about in this piece. And the piece was basically about how libraries had become de facto homeless shelters, and how librarians were now first responders and de facto social workers. And so I went back to the library, as I mentioned, and to see just how bad it had gotten, according to Chip, that it wasn't just localized to Salt Lake City, that it was a national epidemic. And sure enough, everything that he was describing was happening in my downtown branch.
And I mean, because again, over a decade to put this together, the film is finally coming out, but right. I mean, right away did you know there's a story that has to be told?
Yes, I began to imagine what it would look like on, and again, we don't experience the sort of cold that the Midwest does, but I began to think about a story and imagine a story that what would happen if it did get cold here and the patrons decided to stage an old-fashioned 60s Occupy sit-in, and how law enforcement would react, and how the media would spin it, how the local politicians might twist it and turn it to change the narrative to their benefit. So again, this was back in 2007, and every year that the movie wasn't getting made, there was, and I'm not saying that I'm prescient on any level, but I'm just saying that there were more arguments that for reasons for why this movie needed to get made as the years went on. And I found myself not being able to let it go and not being able to shake this idea of getting this film made. Of course, now I look like an opportunist and a vulture. But that is certainly not the case. This was something that was a long time gestating and a long time to get to the screen. And it's just sort of a happy / sad accident that it is, in fact, more relevant now than it would have been.
Ray, I mean, you hear about this movie, and I actually started looking around. I said, wait a minute, how many movies have I ever watched in my life about libraries and about a librarian? This is the central character, but not just the character he plays. The library plays a central character role in the whole story. But I mean, you found out about it. What? How did you make it happen? Bringing him here and making sure that as many people could watch it.
Well, I wish it was me who had the magic to make it happen.
Oh, go ahead and take the credit. Why not?
We really got a call out of the blue, and when we first heard about this movie last October or so. Many of our staff were interested, of course, and excited about it. And we got the call that we were going to be treated to a private screening of it. And, we are going to be having that screening tonight. And it's going to be a bunch of our library staff, as well as some board members from our local homeless trust and other organizations that are tied into libraries and homelessness care throughout the county. So we think it's going to be a good learning experience for all of us. And hopefully will re-inspire us in how we approach you know, our approach to dealing with people who are experiencing homelessness on a day-to-day basis.
And, you know, I mean, I also wanted to get your take, too, on the depiction of librarians and life in the library, a daily life in a library. Your thoughts on that and how it was covered?
Well, I thought it was very realistic. Obviously, like I said, we have 50 different libraries, and they're all very different. You know, our libraries that are closer to the tourist areas and the downtown areas tend to have, you know, a larger number of homeless folks in them than some of the others. But, you know, what we saw in the movie was very much like what we see on a day-to-day basis in the main library or the Miami Beach Regional Library, where we're accustomed to having a large number of folks who are experiencing homelessness. And they're part of, you know, our everyday life as well as any other patron who walks in the building.
You know, the movie, I think the central theme, at least from what I gathered from it, is, again, how we view this particular portion of our population. Really, though, it tackles, I mean, you're talking about, you know, how politicians handle it, the media handles anything, and also really how police, too, their
That's
relations
right.
with
That's right.
The homeless and the communities of color. But let's stick to the issue of homelessness and this conversation about this portion of our population that we see all the time, but we kind of just brush off because we just do. It's just, I don't know, I can't tell you why. So much of this movie, Emilio, obviously it takes place in this library, and we see this population of homeless. They're regulars.
That's right.
They're bathing and cleaning themselves in the bathroom. They're spending a lot of time on the computer. Your experience, I mean, in libraries throughout your life, how often did you see this portion of the population? Did you think about it?
So when I was doing research for Bobby, I was certainly aware of it. The need, though, has grown over these last 12 years. And what we've seen is an overpopulation of people who are on the streets occupying the library because their choices are very limited. So I believe that we need to get to sustainable, permanent housing first. We need to, and we can't make it conditional. So that right now, when people are sheltered, there's like a 3 to 4 hour lag, depending on when the library opens, from when the shelters, or when you're put out from the shelter to where the next place you can go. So there's 3 or 4 hours. Let's start putting housing first. Let's put a roof over it, because when you start to do the numbers, I'll just mention the LA numbers. For emergency services or emergency assistance, for somebody who's on the street experiencing homelessness, it's $68,000 a year. When you put a roof over that same individual's head, it goes down to 15. So 15,000 versus 68,000. We all pay that either way. So how do we get to a place where we are at housing first, so that the libraries can not only serve those individuals experiencing homelessness, but not be the only place that they have to go?
And it's interesting you say that too. You get the tension. Early in the movie, everybody's waiting to get inside.
That's right.
And it's just this line of people.
That's right.
And then,
which
of course,
is true all the way across the country. Every right. library that we visit and we get there early, they're all waiting out in front.
Right. And then, of course, closing time, trying to get everybody to leave.
That's right.
And telling people, well, just go to the shelter. But as one of the characters in the movie said, that's a 40-minute walk away.
That's
and
right.
And it's freezing cold outside. Ray, I mean, you know, depending on the library, but I've been to at Coral Gables, Kendall here downtown as well. You know, depending on which library, you'll see maybe a couple, maybe more, maybe a dozen or more homeless, and they are hanging out waiting to get into the library, or even after it's closed, they stay within that vicinity. What's the conversation like in the libraries with librarians, with the staff, as to, you know, because look, you treat everybody the same, but at the same time, this is a unique group. They don't go to a home. This is a big, this is important for them. How do you talk about with your staff how you're supposed to treat the homeless and what to do and how to help them with their issues?
Well, you know, I hate keep going back to the idea of treat them all like you would treat anyone else, because they do have different needs than everybody else. And, you know, we try to encourage our librarian staff to help them out with getting them down a path where they're getting help with identification cards, getting access to websites where they can get help with Social Security, helping them try to get in contact with relatives that might be able to help them get out of their current station in life. So,
an important part of the movie is how it's having internet access.
Yes, absolutely. And they sometimes need help with that. They might need help learning how to set up an email account. You know, things that some of us take for granted, you know, the librarian is there to help them, you know, push them in the right direction and hope that that help that we're giving them while they're in the library before it closes helps get them down the path when they leave the library at night, the path they need to go.
Again, I'm talking with Ray Baker, director of Miami-Dade's Public Libraries, and actor-director Emilio Estevez, who stars and wrote the new film, The Public. That film, by the way, in theaters this weekend in South Florida, takes a look at the relationship between public libraries and the homeless community. It covers a lot of themes, really fascinating film. Emilio, a number of the homeless depicted in the movie are struggling with mental illness.
That's right.
Substance abuse. Looking at the research, it's estimated between 25-30% of homeless in the United States dealing with mental health issues. The research going into that, what were some of the things that you found that surprised you?
Well, it's that fine line between being a researcher or a journalist slash journalist and being a vulture. Because I was allowed access and not only to the libraries and the staff and the closed stacks but all of the things that the library offers, including access to a lot of the patrons who were the regulars. And you know, it varied from day to day. Some days I'd be spit on and screamed at. Other days I would individuals who were experiencing homelessness would share stories that were oftentimes heartbreaking, but also hilarious. And my full disclosure was, here's what I'm doing. Are you willing to participate in a dialogue? I don't know where that dialogue is going to go or how it's going to ultimately be used in the body of the film, but are you willing to have this dialogue? And for the most part, the answer was yes.
Fascinating scene. One point, you have a homeless man in the library. And again, you play a librarian, and you have to deal with a lot of people's challenges. It's not just, people make the assumption librarians are just sitting around and reading
around
all the
and
time,
read all day.
You know?
That's right.
But you show your characters, the characters in the movie show how, no, it's, you've got all these needs, all these different people. And in one situation, you have a character who is, he's standing by the window.
That's right.
Naked.
That's right.
Singing out loud.
That's right.
And now you've got to figure out, how do you deal with this guy?
Right.
How often in the research did you find that, you know, people will have mental breakdowns?
Of course, yeah. It's on the daily. And librarians, again, are not only tasked with having to diffuse situations like you see in the film, but also now they are tasked with having to learn how to administer Narcan, which is not even 12 years ago was that part of the conversation. So,
because I've heard you mention before, it's like they're not just there as a Google to answer your questions. They're first responders in a way. They're the first people, you know, they've got to deal with security issues.
That's right. That's right.
Ray, how are librarians trained? So it's not just about being able to find information and answer questions, but how are they trained? Is this part of the training to be a librarian to actually administer Narcan?
Yeah, the tricky thing about being a librarian is that you couldn't possibly be trained for everything that you need to know every day. And, you know, it's something, you know, quite frankly, we struggle with. And how do we get people as experts in every single one of these areas? We're not using an Narcan yet, but we regularly have people who occasionally pass out in our bathrooms and need to have an ambulance there right away to, you know, revive them. So it's something that we see every day in some of our branches. A lot of our disturbances are associated with people who are mentally ill, as you were pointing out.
What's the process?
Yeah.
If you have like that scene in the movie, you have someone who's having a mental breakdown or any kind of episode, what's the process? How are you supposed to handle that?
Sure. In the branches where we do have a lot of disturbances like that, we would usually have either police officers or security guards in there who will approach them in a kind way and try to calm them down, and usually remove them from the library. So depending on the level of the infraction, you know, we might evict them for the rest of the day, maybe the week, depending on whether or not they were violent or not. So it varies.
And yeah. The Miami-Dade library system is working with FIU in getting social workers you want to get social workers into the library.
Yeah, we're trying to work on a program with them to get the students who are getting social work degrees, the master's degrees, to develop a program where they can come into the libraries and try to provide social work and work with some of our patrons that are in the libraries.
And this is a system that started in San Francisco, and it's been a very, very successful program. And it's really taken the burden off of the desk reference librarians to deal with a lot of the issues that these individuals are experiencing. There's also, and he's been traveling with us, and the he I'm going to get to in a second. Ryan Dowd wrote a book called The Librarian's Guide to Homelessness. And so he's been traveling not only with me, but before he and I met, he was traveling around the country. The book had just been published, and he offers training to specifically to librarians about how to deal with people experiencing homelessness and mental illness in an empathetic approach. And so, so he's been very helpful along this 35 city tour that we've been doing on the film that started. It started last year, but it started in earnest this January.
And I want to clarify too. If I've been saying it comes out April 5th, right?
April 5th.
Thank you. Sorry about
nationwide.
That. Nationwide. Because it's actually Library Week is like a couple of days after
April 8th.
That.
Yeah. That's right.
There you
go. Good timing on that.
The movie. All right. So the gist of the movie then is basically here you have this Arctic chill that comes through Cincinnati, and the homeless that are in the library are like, there's nowhere for us to go. We're going to freeze to death. And they come to your character and say, listen, we're going to do what they did in Wall Street. We're going to occupy this place. Let's barricade ourselves in.
That's right.
Then your character has to make a decision.
Right.
No, you have to leave, or okay, let's do this.
But he's a librarian to the last, because even when he goes to Jeffrey Wright, his boss, the city librarian, he doesn't even tell Jeffrey's character what they're doing, because he's still protecting the patron's right to privacy. So he doesn't give anybody up. He doesn't. He is a librarian all the way to the end. In fact, you know how the movie ends. He still has his lanyard on. So,
I don't want to give anything away. Fascinating ending. You tackle again. You tackle the issue of homelessness. You tackle police relations with the homeless and communities of color. How again all these different groups handle this issue. The other thing, though, too, is it makes us rethink who librarians are.
Right. And it is also it's a celebration of what nonviolent civil disobedience looks like in the extreme, right? And the fact that that action takes place in this institution, which Eric Kleinenberg calls the cornerstone of the social infrastructure that is so important and vital to every community, that this action takes place under the roof of this building is even more, it makes the action even more potent.
I will agree that I'll never hear that song the same way again. I can see clearly now.
That was an accident, by the way. It was supposed to be Journey's song, Don't Stop Believing. Mm. And they said no 2 weeks before we started shooting. So I had to find another song quickly.
I think it was a good choice.
I do too.
Very good choice. The movie is called The Public. Again, written, directed, and stars Emilio Estevez. Out in theaters, April 5th. We've also been talking with Ray Baker, director of the Miami-Dade Public Libraries. And you know what? We want to hear from you. If you've worked or you do work in a library, tell us about your training and how you handle so many of the issues. Tell us what it means to be a librarian that we don't know. We know you don't just sit around and read books. By the way, and we want to continue this conversation about libraries. Again, as we mentioned, National Library Week coming up April 7th through the 13th. WLRN is asking listeners about their local library. Tell us why you love your library. Text the word library to 786-786-7826. Again, library 786-786-7826. We'd love to hear your stories. Emilio, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Really, really fun, very fascinating film. Ray, thank you for coming in.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
All right. Still to come, we're going to go to the Lowe Museum for an exhibit from one of Argentina's former experimental artists. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Marcelo Bonavardi is said to be one of Argentina's most distinguished experimental artists of the 20th century. Also an architect, Bonavardi mixed his love for shapes and geometry into his artwork. Now, there's an array of his works currently on display at the University of Miami's Lowe Art Museum. The exhibition, Marcelo Bonavardi, Magic Made Manifest, includes paintings, drawings, and sculptures, as well as some works which have never been exhibited before. It is divided into two sections, a room with big, masterful works, and another with more technical, smaller ones, even notebooks. The Sundial team visited the museum recently, and we spoke with his son, also architect Gustavo Bonavardi, about his father's legacy and work. He also has the curator of the exhibition, and you can find photos, by the way, on Facebook at WLRN Sundial.
When you talk to art lovers, but those who haven't known your father's work, how do you describe it to them? How do you introduce them to your father?
He's trained as an architect, and his father was an architect. And I think that that's very evident when you see the work. A lot of the pieces are entitled wall, window, rampart, architectural elements. And in fact, in the later pieces, you'll even find paintings that have moldings in them and real architectural pieces. And some works that are being exhibited is a piece of sheetrock, a piece of construction material, which has been carved. So his relationship to architecture is very strong and very important. You can see in my dad's work, different periods of time, he would become very interested in different things. And that's also reflected in this exhibit, where there's the sort of monographic exhibition, which is these two rooms that is the center of my dad's show, one organized chronologically and one with smaller works organized thematically. But then there's a few pieces that are placed throughout the museum, where there's a terrific collection of African tribal art. There's Greek and Roman pieces from antiquity. There's an incredible Renaissance art collection. And works of my dad have been placed in those exhibition halls. And it's really appropriate because they show my dad's interest and study of those periods.
I wonder, for you growing up, you get to be around someone like that and you're a part of it in some way. How did that impact you as a kid, and when did you know you wanted to be part of this world too?
My dad's studio was always my favorite place, and I always would be right next to him working away, and he would give me tools and a saw and a piece of wood and a little chisel or something to carve away or play with. So it was always part of my life. It was important, and I loved it. And then even as I continued on my own with my studies and going to architecture school myself, our conversations would become, you know, less playful and really discussing architectural history and also discussing his work. We had a very active dialogue, and we were very close in that way.
Let's talk about this exhibit. You have a wide collection of his work on display from different years, different eras, and different styles. You know, so how would you tell people what to expect and how to approach it?
It's the first exhibit that has ever been done, to my knowledge, of my dad's, of this sort. And it's not a true retrospective exhibit in that it doesn't really include maybe the first 20 years or so of his work, but it picks up of when my father began breaking the picture plane and inserting three-dimensional objects within his paintings. What I would love people to do is to really take their time. And the best thing to do would really is to sort of go back and forth between the two rooms, where by looking at the large pieces chronologically, you begin to understand the development of my dad's work over the years. But then when you look at the ideas being developed thematically, when you look at the wall, for example, which has heads on it, which has paintings, drawings, sculptures, all which somehow relate to the idea of heads or masks, and then you go into the other room with the larger pieces and you see those ideas again reflected. You sort of learn how to look at the pieces, many of which in the smaller room are works which have never been exhibited before, the works that have never left my dad's studio.
You have the works, but here you also have small collections of his drawings, his sketchbooks, his paintbrushes. So it's almost like we're not just seeing the final work, we're seeing the tools that he used to create them.
The way something was done and the intention with which something was done was always very important for my father. The sequence of how he went about conceiving a piece, laying it out in a sort of almost an architectural plan, proportional systems and sort of just very abstract geometric studies, then turned into these constructed boxes, which would then be, you know, wrapped with other materials and painted and carvings and would develop. But the whole process was very important for my father. And I think that exhibiting the tools and exhibiting the sketchbooks and studies do a lot to help one get into it and see the work that way.
I'm speaking with Gustavo Buonavardi, artwork by his father, Marcello Buonavardi. He's currently on display at the Lowe Art Museum in an exhibition called Magic Made Manifest. The exhibition is on display through May 26. Your father wasn't an outwardly political person so much, and yet in his work, in his drawings especially, you did see how a lot of the turmoil that was going on in Argentina was impacting his work. Describe a little bit about that and how did he approach, you know, the stuff that was going on back in his home country?
Yeah, in the mid-70s, my dad took up drawing again with a very sort of focused concentration in a way that he hadn't in many, many years. And they're very forceful charcoal drawings and show his architectural training and to a great degree and have very haunting sort of images, a lot of hooks and skins and cages and frankly, instruments that look like instruments of torture. And it was pointed out in hindsight. I mean, it wasn't during the time, but it was then pointed out that, you know, this is the time when the La Guerra Sucia, the dirty war, was going on in Argentina. And I know for a fact that it impacted my father very, very personally with, you know, old classmates of his having their children disappear. And he was very aware of what was going on and very impacted by it. So that these drawings came out during that period, you can't overlook that, you know, that coincidence. I would say, on the other hand, that my dad was not a particular fan of political art like the murals of Diego Rivera or that kind of art. And I think that maybe that imagery might have been coming out even without my dad's real, he might not have even consciously sort of seen the relationship. But to me, it's unavoidable.
I wanted to ask you about the book because it took you a while to put the book together. Tell me a little bit about, you know, that process and what you wanted it to kind of convey to everybody else about your father's work.
My dad was living in Argentina. I was in New York, and I got the phone call from my sister that my dad was ill. He had cancer, and it wasn't good. The first thing I did was to call up Dory Ashton, a wonderful, amazing, and incredible art historian, who had previously written an essay on my dad, and asked them if they would be on board to do a book on my dad's. So they immediately said yes. I went to Argentina with the news for my dad that we were starting a book on his work, and he died 5 days later. He was incredibly happy and excited that this project was underway. So it meant a lot to me that he was able to know that this was going to happen. It took 10 years to finally get it done. It was a huge undertaking. My dad wasn't the most prolific artist of the 20th century, but he did a lot of work, and it's very diverse work. And just getting it all photographed and the selections and getting the essayists to get their essays in on time and everything, it's just a very, very slow process. And quite a difficult one, and one which I did together with John Bennett, who's the co-curator of this exhibit and a like major expert on my dad's work at this point. We together got this book together, and it's a wonderful monograph to have to, you know, be able to present my dad's work to people.
Something else fascinating too is in one of the displays we get to see again some of his tools, but also there was what looked like a swatch, really. It was colors with recipes and how to create those colors. And he did that. He was very, very methodical, it seems, in how he developed the colors that he would use.
Yeah, my dad was very methodical in all of his work, even in his process, where he would get up in the morning and put his work clothes on and work until whatever hour was the end of his work day. The way he worked on his pieces was the same. He would start out with plans, maybe very much in a sort of architectural kind of way of working. And likewise, what we show in the is only a few pages of what is a very large book of paint swatches that my dad would do, where he would mix colors and the precise recipes that he used to get those colors so that he could later go back and say, I want this blue or I want that red, and he would know how to make it. He would also, for you know, very specific paintings, he would write down the steps and the ingredients he used to do those. It's interesting that my dad was also an avid cook, and we have cookbooks which are actually very much the same way, where he would have his recipes, and he would, like, you know, became obsessed with quiche for a while there, and we had quiche every day, and he would alter his recipes and test them out, and so this kind of approach was a very kind of, he was a very methodical and organized man in everything.
Gustavo Buonavarti, it was a beautiful exhibit. Thank you so much for sharing with us.
Well, thank you very much, Louis.
That is Gustavo Buonavarti, son of Argentinian artist Marcelo Buonavarti. His father's artwork is displayed at the University of Miami's Lowe Art Museum. The exhibition is called Marcelo Buonavarti Magic Made Manifest. It'll be on display through May 25th. You can find photos on Facebook at WLRN Sundial. Well, that's the program for this Wednesday, March 27th. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening.